Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Folks, it's Friday, and you know what that means. It's time to recap some of the biggest local and national stories from this week. From the upcoming shelter move-out date for some migrants.
With the deadline looming for migrants to start being evicted from Chicago's shelters, Mayor Brandon Johnson is now saying it will be enforced with some exceptions. But there are still questions about how the process will work and where people will go.
To state government.
Illinois' governor is pushing for a new reform bill that targets unfair practices in the insurance industry.
To the pandemic.
4 years ago, the World Health Organization declared the novel coronavirus outbreak a global pandemic.
And of course, we can't do this by ourselves. This week, we were joined by a panel of A-list local reporters. Julie Bosman is the Chicago Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Mariah Wolfel is a city government and politics reporter for WBEZ. And Dan Petrella is a state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. First, we dug into the mandatory shelter move-out date for the first group of migrants, which has already been delayed 3 times. Mariah, what's the latest on that?
Sure. So a briefing is actually going on right now with reporters and city department officials, commissioners, giving us the details finally a day before this eviction deadline is set to go into effect tomorrow. The latest is that no one will be forced to leave shelter tomorrow because tomorrow's deadline applied to the people who were in shelter earliest, you know, stretching back to November of last year when the city announced this policy.
Okay.
And so nearly all of the 50 people who were faced with the deadline tomorrow have already left shelter, either found housing or decided on a different path. There's one person remaining, city officials said.
Okay.
And that person is waiting for their utilities to be turned on at their new apartment. But that's not to say hundreds of people won't be affected by this going forward. These are rolling deadlines based on when you've entered shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And so what city officials said is that there are about 2,026 people between now and the end of April who will be affected by eviction deadlines. And so that could change as more people find housing and aren't faced with this eviction deadline. To break that down, 125 people will be affected between now and March 17th.
Okay.
And so it's really going to be, you know, dozens to hundreds of people on a rolling basis,
like a rolling
every single day, based on when you've entered shelter. And then the city did announce some new policies and exemptions today, including you will be exempt for quarantine. So if people are quarantined because of the measles, you'll be exempt from evictions.
Well, let's hear from Mayor Johnson.
Sure.
I do have tape of when he talked about this prior to the briefing, talking about migrants who were issued exemptions.
Mm-hmm. As far as the 60-day policy, we've had migrants in shelter since 2002. Again, that's not the design of the system that we are trying to hold up. So what this policy has essentially done, it has given us the opportunity to have real substantive conversations with migrants to help them move on. So what does that mean? There are exemptions, even within this policy, that are still permissible.
Yeah, so talk more about that.
That was a winding answer to a very basic question I asked. So some of those exemptions are if you're a pregnant woman, you can be exempt. If you're in the midst of securing housing, so if you're like in the process of signing a lease, you'll be exempt. The city is also now offering an exemption to anyone who has a child through June, because there were a lot of concerns about how this could disrupt students' schooling at CPS.
Mm-hmm.
If you're also trying to find housing or moving from shelter to shelter or moving from a shelter back to the landing zone.
Right.
And so that's really the biggest exemption change. And then medical exemptions, if you have extenuating medical circumstances. But the exemptions for families with children is the big news.
Yeah. And though, Dan, as Mariah talked about, you know, some of these evictions will happen sort of on a rolling basis, and it will impact those without these exemptions. So I wonder how you think this looks for the mayor, right? And for Governor Pritzker, even for President Biden.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because this policy was announced back in November, and it keeps the deadlines have continued to be pushed back. You know, we're going on four
That's
months
right.
now without really any of these sort of mass evictions.
Let's just
scenarios.
Say I didn't bat an eyelash when Mariah was like, well, no one's leaving tomorrow.
Yes,
I just wasn't 100% surprised.
Right. And one of the issues is at the same time, the state cut its rental assistance program from being a six-month program to a three-month program and then cut it off for people who arrived after that date in mid-November. And so, I mean, the question now is where people go after 60 days, the process of getting people approved for work permits where they can be legally earning money to support themselves has been slow. And so, you know, I think there's a real question about whether this exacerbates the already significant problem with homelessness that Chicago is experiencing. You know, the state has been working hard to help people who want to go to someplace other than Chicago to get on trains and planes and buses and whatever else they need to do to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting is not the right word, but important to watch what happens as a result of people running out of time at shelters.
Yeah, and Julie, plenty of people have migrants on their mind this week, as we know, but a whole lot of folks also have measles on their mind. There's an outbreak at a crowded Pilsen migrant shelter that's got folks concerned about this deadline and deadlines to come. Do you have the latest numbers or any thoughts on how the city's been dealing with that?
I do. The latest number on the measles outbreak in Chicago is 12 cases in the last week. And you can imagine that these are two headlines that the Johnson administration does not want blaring at the same time, measles outbreak and migrants evicted from shelter. Yeah. So they're clearly trying to avoid that. And the outbreak in the shelter is still very much ongoing. The cases keep rising. You have some people who have recovered and are doing better, mm-hmm. but I would not be surprised if these cases increase in the next week or two. The Department of Public Health has been very active in immunizing as yeah. many people who are living in that shelter as
hundreds.
Possible. Hundreds.
Hundreds.
The last number I saw was 900
yeah.
Vaccinations. But clearly this is a group of people who are not vaccinated fully. And it's almost surprising that we haven't seen an outbreak like this since there have been yeah. so many migrants coming to Chicago.
And the CDC is involved now, right?
It is. CDC arrived on Tuesday with a team to assist CDPH and the State Department of Public Health.
Actually, after telling one of my colleagues on Monday that you have to ask the city questions about this measles outbreak, told us later in the week that on Monday they had opened a hotel sort of quarantine shelter for folks as a result of that measles outbreak, specifically for people who need to leave the shelter to quarantine and be away to try and slow the spread of the measles.
The city also announced today, I should add, that residents, migrants, will now be required for measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox vaccinations.
Oh, really?
Upon, you know, getting to the city's landing zone, in order to enter shelter, they'll need to be vaccinated against those things and will be denied shelter if they refuse. We asked the city if people currently staying in shelter, if they refuse vaccination, if they would be kicked out of shelter. And the city said it so far hasn't had that issue, mm-hmm. That it's trying to educate people about why this is needed and that so far they haven't had pushback.
Yeah, two of the measles patients from the Pilsen shelter, they attend Chicago Public Schools. So as a mom, I mean, I'm thinking immediately about how quickly even a cold can pass among kids, right? I also got alarmed when I got the emails from CPS over the last week about the measles outbreak. Something to note, though, is that, you know, while students typically are required to be vaccinated to enroll in schools here in Illinois, migrants can be exempted from vaccination. So that's, you know, another worrying piece of the puzzle here. I do want to stick with migrants for another moment here, Mariah. Our Sun-Times colleague Michael Loria had a story about the Catholic Archdiocese offering to house migrants for free, but the city didn't take them up on the offer. Help us make sense of that.
Yeah, so our colleague Michael, through documented emails, revealed that the Archdiocese has space in more than 60 shuttered churches, schools, and other buildings that are listed for sale or lease in the city. And he found that the city so far hasn't taken them up on offers to use those buildings. In response, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson this week said that, you know, kind of implied that these spaces weren't immediately suitable for living. You know, yeah. you have to have all of the things that people need to live. And so he did say we're working on one with the Archdiocese, but the urgency here is that the city is spending millions of dollars to rent private space for shelters. There are some shelters in, you know, Chicago Park District buildings and publicly owned buildings that the city is using for free, but the vast majority of migrants are being housed in yeah. private owned space that you know, is costing the city millions to rent out.
But Oak Park did take the Archdiocese up on their offer to temporarily house some folks. Julie, you've been looking closely at suburban responses to the migrant situation. What are you finding?
Well, Oak Park really stands alone there.
Really?
They were much earlier than any other suburb that I can tell. They really stepped up, which feels fitting with Oak Park and its proximity to the city and the progressive nature of people who live there. What I've written about and others have written about recently is what's happening on the North Shore, and there are some very active residents there in Wilmette, in Highland Park, who have realized, okay, we have a lot of migrant buses that are coming here unannounced, and then the people who are on those buses were being dropped at the Metra or sometimes dropped at like the Linden station. It was all kind of a confusing muddle, but they've really tried to step up and at least help people get coats, shoes. You know, there were people wearing shower slides coming off of these buses and then getting on the Metra and going downtown. So, you know, it's, I don't think that people are going to the lengths that a lot of people in Oak Park have gone to, but you can see that the suburban communities have really started to respond.
Time to turn to the primary election, folks, which is just 4 days away. It's on Tuesday. The issue, though, that's gotten a lot of attention, Mariah, bring Chicago home. Mm-hmm. It's had a few more legal twists and turns, I hear. Get us up to speed.
Yeah, so this seems to be the end to the legal saga that we've seen for now ahead of the election, which is that the Illinois Supreme Court sided with the city, well, you know, denied a motion for appeal by the real estate coalition that aimed to block the referendum question from the ballot. And so, I mean, just the latest, too long didn't read, is that the question is on the ballot, votes will be counted, and if this referendum is passed, voters will be authorizing the Chicago City Council to increase the real estate transfer tax on high-end properties for homelessness prevention and decrease it on property valued under $1 million. And so it's basically as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
And we are where we were,
you know,
a month ago. But
somehow.
But that's the latest. And so that will be on the ballot.
Yeah. On Wednesday, Mayor Johnson unveiled the next phase in what he's calling a hyper-local approach to crime prevention. Let's change gears here and listen to this clip.
When I say hyper-local, I mean we are looking at the challenges and opportunities for our neighborhoods, literally block by block by block.
What does he mean, Mariah? Any more details on this?
Well, these are really hyper-local areas in four neighborhoods. There are 10 so-called block groups where the city's going to focus its violence prevention efforts. And those neighborhoods are Inglewood, Austin, Little Village, and West Garfield Park. And, you know, it's kind of scant on details about how this will actually look on the ground. But they are pitching that this will have real life implications for residents because the areas are so small.
Yeah.
Some of the most violent, you know, block groups in the city as identified by officials. They also identified these areas by looking at indicators of disinvestment, like how many schools have been closed on these blocks? What's the availability of parks and libraries? And what they're saying is that they're going to do layered investments in those areas over time to help revitalize economic corridors, bring back banks, grocery stores, all of the things that are needed to make a neighborhood or a block area thrive. And so really the update this week was announcing those areas.
Interesting. Well, I mean, Julie, investing in neighborhoods as a way to combat crime, it sounds like another clear example of Johnson's progressive agenda.
It does. And I think it's interesting that it's coming at a moment when this administration, this police department, this city is making real strides in lowering its numbers of not just shootings, but homicides. I think the latest numbers I saw citywide were 12% down for the year. So this is really building on what's happening in, you know, all over the country or in many, many major cities around the country.
So do you think then that this anti-crime investment plan has any impact on Johnson's reputation then outside of Chicago?
I think that he'll have to be able to sustain what's happening now. Like, I think it's just too early. And one thing that, as you know, happens with Chicago is that it is sometimes an outlier in terms of violence when you see, compare it to New York, to Los Angeles, those cities see decreases, Chicago sees an increase. So I think we'll have to wait and see.
All right, Dan, I'm going to turn to citywide races on Tuesday's ballot because, of course, there are a lot of races We want to help folks make sense of some of them if we can. So I want to turn to the state's attorney race, which is heating up.
Yes, this is probably the most contentious race on the ballot on Tuesday, and it's one that voters across all of Cook County will see on their ballots. You've got Eileen O'Neill Burke, who's a retired appellate judge, and you've got Clayton Harris III, who is a former prosecutor, has worked for some jobs in the corporate world, worked in some government jobs, including a brief stint as the chief of staff to former Governor Rod Blagojevich. And they are running to take on the office that's been run for the last two terms by Kim Fox. And crime in Chicago is a big factor in this race. You know, it's Kim Fox is one of the progressive prosecutors who came into office sort of in a wave that was happening around the country several years ago. And, you know, in various places, you know, we saw a similarly minded prosecutor recalled in San Francisco, for example. Kim Fox decided not to run for a third term. And, you know, her legacy is a big question in the race and whether, you know, whether the candidates want to embrace that legacy or run away from it. Mm-hmm. Clayton Harris has gotten a little closer to saying he supports some of what Kim Fox has done in office. For example, not charging felony retail thefts unless they're over $1,000 as opposed to $300, which is the actual bar in state law. Eileen O'Neill Burke has been very critical of Kim Fox. You know, she gave a speech to the City Club several days ago where she really blamed Fox for mismanagement and low morale in the state's attorney's office. And it's also become a race about who's a better Democrat. You know, O'Neill Burke has gotten some sizable contributions from people who typically contribute to Republicans. You know, it's been a long time since a Republican has won the state's attorney's race in Cook County. So a lot of people view the winner on Tuesday as the winner in November kind of by default.
And interesting.
So, yeah.
And Cook County Circuit Court Clerk Iris Martinez is also facing a primary fight. Mariah, before you catch us up on that contest, though, can you just remind us, what does the circuit court clerk do exactly?
Well, it's a boring name unless you like alliteration.
Circuit court clerk.
For Cook County. Cook County Circuit Court Clerk.
Yeah. Say that five times.
But it's an important office. You know, this office oversees and archives records for the Cook County court system, the second largest court system in the nation. So there's a lot to say about accessibility to court records and just being able to keep the public informed on what's going on in the courts, and also very important for people going through that system as well.
Yeah. And so what's going on with this race? Incumbent Iris Martinez is facing a challenge from longtime Metropolitan Water Reclamation District Commissioner Mariana Spiropoulos. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Dan?
Yeah, and this is a really interesting race because Martinez is the incumbent. She's a former state senator, but she does not have the backing of the Cook County Democratic Party. She's sort of ruffled some feathers within the party. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, who's the chair of the county party, and the committee people decided to back the challenger in this race. And so it's been a bit of a heated competition. It is an office that is, you know, maybe not the most exciting to everyday people, but, you know, again, like Mariah said, important to people who are in the court system, also important to people like us who need to be able to get access to court documents to do our jobs. And it's an office that has had a history of scandal in its past. So it is one that's worth paying attention to.
All right. Time to turn from what's going on in Chicago to what's happening throughout the state. Dan, the state capitol was placed in lockdown Tuesday afternoon. What happened there?
Yes, there was apparently a threat to the building. The Secretary of State's office, which is in charge of security for the state capitol, hasn't really released a lot of information specific about what the threat was. It was a kind of a short-term lockdown, and then people were able to sort of resume the day. You know, this is not a totally hypothetical issue. 20 years ago, there was an unarmed security guard who was shot and killed at the capitol, and that sort of is what prompted the security measures that are in place there now, armed Secretary of State police, metal detectors, things like that. So always something to take seriously. I was texting with Jeremy Gordner, who's our Springfield reporter, while it was happening, and making sure, like, you know, there's an exit to get out over here if you need to.
Yeah, like, are you okay,
buddy? Sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So always frightening, but, you know, glad to hear that it was nothing.
Better to be safe than sorry, for sure. Now, the governor's pushing his insurance bill, Dan. This is legislation that would reform insurance plans. Tell us, what are some of those reforms and what kind of reception are they getting in Springfield?
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting surprise turn in his State of the State and Budget speech a few weeks ago now.
Yeah, what is that, 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago?
And, you know, he came out and said he wants to end things like prior authorization for mental health care, which is where, you know, you have to get permission from your insurance company before you can go and get treatment for certain things. He also wants to crack down on what's called step therapy, where a doctor recommends a certain course of treatment and your insurance company says, wait, no, why don't you try this cheaper, possibly, you know, medicinal option first before you go and do that more expensive surgery or treatment or whatever. And they're also trying to crack down on what they refer to as ghost networks, where, you know, you'll search for what providers are in your network and you'll get a whole list and then you'll call around and know they don't actually take your insurance or know that office doesn't exist anymore. You know, other Democrats in Springfield seem somewhat excited about this idea. There is obviously going to be a lot of opposition from the insurance industry, which kind of seems put out that they've been cast as sort of the bad guy in this situation. The governor vowed to expend political capital to get this done, so it'll be interesting to see how quickly this moves and if it gets through both chambers of the legislature this spring as he has presented it.
That prior authorization that you mentioned, I mean, that's been something that folks have struggled with. We had a powerful conversation about it earlier this week on Reset, where we heard from an Illinois family who's been dealing with that when it comes to chemo treatments for the elderly father. You can listen to that story, shameless plug, wbez.org/reset. Now, sticking with proposed changes to Illinois' healthcare system, some 6,000 Illinoisans who aren't American citizens, Dan, they could lose their health care benefits?
That's right. This is part of a program that the state started a few years ago early on in the pandemic. It started with basically being a Medicaid-style health insurance program for older undocumented immigrants and folks who are waiting for, there's a five-year waiting period when you get your green card before you're eligible for some of those federal programs. This is targeted towards those people who are sort of in the pipeline for their green cards, legal permanent residents, and the state is saying that they qualify for health insurance plans through the health insurance marketplace and things like that. So what they're going to be trying to do is move them out of this more expensive state program, which really, if folks remember last year, kind of almost blew up budget negotiations in Springfield, because this program that had been pitched originally as being, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars ballooned to, oh, maybe this is going to cost us $1 billion this year as they expanded the program to more and more younger folks. And so they're trying to contain costs. They gave the governor some powers to sort of rein in eligibility and try to keep costs down on that program.
Let's circle back to the primary election on Tuesday, Mariah. The race to replace state Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke, that's heating up. What's the latest there?
Right. So this is the one contested Illinois Supreme Court race. It's between the incumbent Supreme Court Justice Joy Cunningham being challenged by an appellate judge, Jesse Reyes. You know, this is an important race. State Supreme Courts across the country, I think, continue to weigh in on large questions with big implications.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, an important race to watch.
Yeah.
Democrats hold a 5-2 majority on the state Supreme Court currently, and it's likely that they'll maintain that. But nonetheless, a race to pay attention to and to vote informed on.
Yeah, and Jesse Reyes, Dan, is saying that this election is a once in a generation chance to put a Latino on the high court. Do you think that argument would speak to voters?
That's correct. And you know, that's because once you are elected to the court once you're elected to the court, you only stand before voters every 10 years for a retention vote. We did see once recently where a judge was not retained, but it's very rare for that to happen. So it really is sort of as long as you want to be there and can convince folks to vote for you every 10 years that you get to stay on the court.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really become sort of the center point of this race is whether that Latino representation on the court is important, whether it's important enough to switch from the appointed incumbent, Joy Cunningham, who is also a former appellate judge who took the seat when Burke retired. And it's become very, very contentious. Cunningham has made some comments about how, you know, the court is much more diverse than it used to be. There are three black justices on the court now, which not that long ago was all white.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like, you know, it's not practical on a 7-justice court to have every single racial and ethnic group represented necessarily, which she got some blowback for that. And the Latino population in Illinois and in Cook County, which is what comprises this judicial district is growing, whereas the black population has been shrinking. So it's sort of, there's this long running tension in Chicago and Cook County politics between black leaders and Latino leaders. And this has sort of made some of that bubble up.
Interesting. There's a controversy involving disgraced former Alderman Ed Burke in this race.
Yeah, well, speaking of, you know, important issues that the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court rules on, I mean, there were two major stories out of the state Supreme Court this week. And one of them was that former Alderman Ed Burke indicted on a massive racketeering, federal racketeering case last year, will hold his law license because the Illinois Supreme Court failed to suspend it this week. Four justices on the 7-member court cited conflicts of interest and didn't rule on the suspension request from the Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. And so that means that Burke, who faces sentencing this year and faces decades in prison, potentially will hold on to his law license despite being convicted of enriching his private practice by using his public seat to strong arm developers into hiring his law firm. And wow. So not only is he convicted, but he's also convicted as it relates specifically to his law license and his law firm. And I so, see. You know, when the story came out, I think there was a lot of stuff about like only in Chicago would this happen. And, you know, it goes a long way in trying to build trust between the people of Illinois and the governmental bodies that serve it.
Yeah, and speaking of the sort of only in Chicago and only in Illinois thing, I can't remember if we made this connection, but the Ann Burke, who we were just talking about, who is the former Supreme Court Justice, is the wife of Ed Burke, the now convicted former alderman, who also used to run the judicial slating process for the Cook County Democratic Party. So,
but no relation between the state's attorney's candidate.
Correct.
We can all agree there are too many Burkes.
Or the Burke, I think, who ruled in the circuit court on the British
Kathleen
Chicago
Burke.
Home.
Yeah. Judge Kathleen
Burke.
That's right.
Yes. What do you think, Julie, with the ethical issues going on here?
I do agree. Only in Chicago could, you know, so many members of the state, only in Illinois could so many members of the state Supreme Court have conflicts and not be able to take this very common, very standard, even if it only feels symbolic, it is a gesture and a move that I think that people should expect. So you don't have to dig very deep to see that this signals something really troubling.
Yeah. Well, looking at other races on the ballot, Dan, how likely is it that Democrats will maintain their supermajorities in both chambers of the General Assembly?
You know, I think it's going to be a very tough road for Republicans this year, especially with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, to make a big dent in the supermajorities in the state legislature. You know, The House Democrats in Springfield have a modern record, 78 members. You might see them maybe lose a seat or two. I wouldn't even try to predict where, but it wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility. You know, could they pick up a couple seats too and get to 80? I mean, that's maybe also within the realm of possibilities.
You never know.
You know, there are going to be some hotly contested races, I'm sure, this fall. Right now, one of the most interesting races is a Democratic primary in the Senate on the Northwest side, where there's been millions of dollars spent. So it'll be interesting to see how that one shakes out.
Why don't we talk about the two congressional races on Tuesday's ballot? Longtime Chicago Congressman Danny Davis is in a crowded primary.
Yes. You know, Congressman Davis he was first elected in 1996, the year, my math is correct, Bill Clinton won his second term the last time the DNC was here in Chicago. Delegates were dancing the Macarena on the floor.
In
context.
In my middle school cafeteria.
Yeah, in people's minds. You know, and long before that, he was a longtime Cook County commissioner, a city council member before that. Danny Davis has been, you know, in public office for about 45 years in Washington for more than half that time.
Oh, yeah.
But last time out, he won by only 6 points against a progressive activist named Keena Collins, who's back this time to challenge him for the third straight election. He's also facing a challenge from the city treasurer, Melissa Conyers-Irvin, who sort of, you know, saw the outcome last time and seems to see an opening for her to move up. And there are a couple other folks in the race as well, Corey Marshall and Nikhil Bhatia. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how voters sort of divide themselves between those five candidates. Mm-hmm. Davis has all the establishment backing, pretty much the governor, the mayor, Tony Preckwinkle. Nancy Pelosi just came out with an endorsement for him today.
Yeah.
So it's a race where everybody claims to be a progressive, but it's who is more progressive or who is more sort of the common sense candidate. And, you know, he's 82. So age is a factor in this race as well, as we've seen on the presidential.
But he's got all these endorsements and there's this crowded field. I mean, and the ethics issue. I mean, is it likely another victory then?
It's
for Davis.
You know, it's really hard to say. There's not been any real reliable polling in the race that I've seen. The power of incumbency is strong, and I will say that there's a pro-Israel independent political action committee that just in the last week or so has come out with a lot of spending against Kena Collins, who is a... she supports a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. You know, she's probably the furthest left of the field, and so that shows me that at least some people are taking her seriously again this year.
The fact that there are so many endorsements it tells me that he's in such trouble. I mean, my inbox is full of endorsements for Danny Davis, which he should not need at this point in his career.
The one I'm waiting to see is if they pull out the, I was going to say Trump card, which is kind of a weird word for this, but, you know, if Joe Biden comes in and, as he did 2 years ago, endorses Davis, and I think they're kind of waiting to see if they feel like they need that.
And I think one of the reasons Kena Collins, you know, she ran in 2020 and got, I think, around 13% of the vote and then closed that gap drastically in 2022. And, you know, I think one of the reasons she did so well then was, one, building a base, but two, because there were a lot of voters who just want a new face in Congress. Danny Davis's age is playing a big role in this race, with people saying, you know, it's just time for him to retire. We need new energy in this district. But that then factors into whether so many candidates in the Democratic primary actually splits that vote, that anti-Davis vote, or just like new face vote, and opens up a lane for Davis to actually, you know, secure victory.
There was a lot of outside money backing her last time too, which so far there has not been this time. So that's going to be interesting to see whether that she falls back a little bit from where she was last time.
I want to turn to another race. Incumbent Congressman Chuy Garcia is battling three-term Alderman Ray Lopez of the 15th Ward. What's happening here?
Yeah, this is another really fascinating race. Congressman Garcia is sort of one of the progressive standard bearers here in Cook County. He was an ally of Harold Washington on the city council, went on later to become the first Mexican-American state senator in Illinois, then was a Cook County commissioner after taking some time off for politics, was anointed the successor to Luis Gutierrez in this congressional district that was drawn in the 90s to ensure Latino representation in Washington for voters here in Chicago and in Cook County. Lopez is an interesting figure. He's sort of known as being kind of bombastic and an outspoken critic of both former Mayor Lori Lightfoot and current Mayor Brandon Johnson.
Yeah.
He's a frequent guest on Fox News. You know, he tries to portray himself as sort of the more common sense, middle of the road candidate in this race. And it's going to be interesting to see whether, you know, enough of the district is there to cause Garcia any trouble. Garcia has not faced a Democratic primary challenge since being elected to the office, so it's going to be interesting to see how well he does on Tuesday.
Anything else we should know, Mariah, about the history of Chicago's 4th District?
Well, I think that Lopez sees himself with a chance because of how the district was rejiggered in after the 2020 census to include a little bit more of DuPage County, a little bit more of the suburbs. And so I think he's known as one of the most conservative aldermen in the Chicago Democratic City Council body. And so on that scale. But nonetheless, I think he'll try to appeal to who he's hoping are more conservative voters in the suburbs and thinks that gives him a chance at defeating the incumbent.
Your thoughts, Julie? I mean, with Lopez being, as Mariah said, more politically conservative than Garcia, I mean, might the outcome of this race be seen as an indicator of where the Latino vote's heading in the presidential election?
It could be. I mean, I think it's obviously going to be a real uphill climb for Lopez, but he has never backed away from an election that looks like it may not work out for him, as we learned last year.
Although he was the first to announce and first to drop out of the mayor's race.
Oh, yes.
Filing.
How could I forget? Preparations for August's Democratic National Convention continue to move along, Dan. Chicago's getting a boost of federal money. What's that for?
That's right. This was part of the deal that averted whatever number potential government shutdown this was that just bypassed us this past weekend. But Chicago and Milwaukee, which is hosting the Republican convention in July, are each getting $75 million to help with security costs around the conventions. Traditionally, for the past couple decades, host cities have gotten $50 million. The argument was things have gotten a lot more expensive, so let's give the hosts a little bit more money to help with security costs. It can go to, equipment, police overtime, sort of a wide range of things that the city says it will need to keep everybody safe during the convention those 4 days in August when all the Democrats come to the United Center in McCormick Place.
Yeah. Officials from President Biden's staff, it's a separate story here. They were in Chicago, at least in the Chicago area. They were hoping to meet with local Palestinian and Muslim Americans. And as we know, Cook County, we've got more Palestinians than any other county in the U.S. But the meeting didn't go as planned, did it?
It did not. This was supposed to be a meeting between senior White House officials and Arab American and Muslim American activists. And it did not happen as it was supposed to happen because many of the activists decided that they did not want to come. They boycotted the meeting. And why they did that is no surprise. They're very upset with the Biden administration's stance on the war in the Middle East. And this is really one example of how what has happened with the Biden administration and President Biden's reelection campaign in Michigan is just spreading and is going to be repeating itself in cities all over the country. Mm-hmm. It perhaps won't matter as much to him in Illinois because it is a pretty reliably blue state, whereas Michigan is very much up for grabs.
Yeah.
But this is going to be a real problem going forward.
All right, our last political story for today, and not everyone may know this, but about half of the states in the U.S. actually allow 17-year-olds to vote in the primary. That is, if they're going to be 18 by Election Day. The Chicago Teachers Union came under criticism. They were encouraging members to bring their senior students to a rally this morning at CTU headquarters, Mariah. What are some of the concerns?
Sure. The Chicago Teachers Union pegged this as a civic education event. They were going to bring students to this rally or brought students to this rally, and then they were going to march to an early voting site, cast their ballots. It came under fire because Bring Chicago Home, the organization that's backing the increase to the city's real estate transfer tax, was purportedly a sponsor of this event. And so while the Chicago Teachers Union was painting it as, just a blanket objective civic education event, which is something that's certainly supported by Mayor Brandon Johnson, as he expressed this week, and by, civic voting education groups, stuff like that, it seemed that this would be, a more subjective with a very specific leaning event. Yeah. And the fear was that students would feel pressure to vote in favor of the Bring Chicago Home referendum after attending this event. CTU assured CPS this week that Bring Chicago Home would not be a sponsor of the event. Mayor Brandon Johnson said that CTU and teachers involved were reminded of, the ethical policy of CPS ahead of this event. Mm-hmm. And so it, as far as I know, moved forward this morning.
It did. I was there, actually.
Okay.
I came right over from there. And it was really,
Well, thank you for making it on time.
Yes. It was an organization called Chicago Votes and La Casa Norte that were the primary sponsors of the event. CTU hosted it in their headquarters over on the west side. And really it was, the main part was a candidate forum for four of the five candidates in the 7th Congressional District race where, I saw students ask some really well-researched, well-informed questions of the people that they're going to go march and potentially vote for.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it was, I'm not sure how much was, I haven't done the reporting out of how much was changed in response to some of those concerns, but some of the concerns that were portrayed were not what I witnessed when I was there this morning. I will say that I was really impressed with some of the better questions that I feel like I ask sometimes coming from the kids
high schoolers.
Who are
my gosh, students ask the best questions.
Yeah, yeah. I'm biased. I've got teens at home and I'm like, you're pretty smart.
Uh-huh.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Julie Bosman of the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella, and WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel. Julie, this week, believe it or not, this was the 4-year anniversary of that once-in-a-lifetime pandemic that no one's ever going to forget. Of course, I'm talking about COVID. And unfortunately, it doesn't feel like a thing of the past for everyone, right? I mean, you talk to folks for whom COVID is still very real and very present, right?
We did a story this week, mostly based on just reader responses. We did a call out on our website and got so many responses that I literally couldn't read all of them. And what I heard was what I've heard from so many people who have long COVID, who feel that their life has been altered in some way, if not physically, emotionally, spiritually. They just feel that there is no need to move on from this yet, and that we really need to be examining the ways in which our worlds have changed. So it was incredibly interesting just to read the things that people said about what they experienced. And for example, one man that I interviewed who lives in Albuquerque said that he was alone for a year in his apartment. He didn't have a spouse. And he just realized afterward that he didn't want to be lonely again and downloaded a dating app, made a profile, and he's now married and living in that apartment with his wife, Shay. And I thought,
I was hoping for a happy ending.
The COVID was transformative, the pandemic, in so many ways.
Yeah.
And there are little silver linings there.
Yeah. On now to what feels like our weekly stadium update here on the Weekly News Recap. The Bears seem to be steering away from the suburbs. They're singing a different tune. Sweet home Chicago. Right? Dan?
Yes.
Pick up the next line.
I would if I could, but my mind is going blank right now. They unveiled a plan to build a domed stadium on the lakefront near the current site of Soldier Field. They would demolish most of Soldier Field, but leave the colonnade as sort of a memorial to veterans, which is what the stadium was originally built for. There's a lot of questions about beyond the $2 billion that the Bears are saying they will put up, how much the project would cost, how it would be paid for. There's almost certainly going to be opposition from the Friends of the Park group, which people may remember torpedoed George Lucas's plans to build a museum of narrative arts on the lakefront. There's just a lot of questions. And this is all, of course, happening at the same time that the White Sox are trying to build a new stadium, trying to get state and potentially city help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still debt that's being paid from the last two stadium projects that these teams had done. And there has not been a lot of appetite in Springfield, at least. And I'm not so sure what it's been like at City Hall, but
yeah,
to really roll out the red carpet for the team. The other question is, what are the Bears going to do with this $200 million property out in Arlington Heights where they knocked down a historic horse racing?
Right. Yeah. Do you think that they would walk away from this big purchase?
I think there's always the potential that they could, develop it as a side project, some other sort of business venture for the family, for the team, or just sell the property to somebody else who wants to develop it. So, I think folks in Arlington Heights who want the Bears to come there are a little bit nervous. But also, there's at least some state legislators in Arlington Heights who have never been so gung-ho about it.
Yeah, the Arlington Heights village manager said the Bears have, quote, confirmed that their continued interest in Arlington Park has not changed. End quote.
Right. And that's hard to square with.
Drop.
That's hard to square with, these pretty pictures of a nice domed stadium on the lakefront. So, I don't see the legislative session is scheduled to wrap up toward the end of May. And obviously it's an election year. It's hard to imagine much getting done this spring. We'll see what happens when lawmakers return to Springfield after the November election. You never know.
It'll be interesting. Yeah. Well, although this stadium saga has plenty of folks frustrated with the Bears, there's one person thrilled with the football team and Chicago, and that's four-time Olympic gold medal gymnast Simone Biles. Her husband, who's the former Green Bay Packers defensive back, Jonathan Owens, just signed with the Bears this week. And she went to Twitter expressing her excitement for Chicago's food scene on social media. She says, "Chicago, here he comes." I'm reading her actual tweets right now. She says, "I'm so excited about not having a connecting flight to go and see my husband." Just, touting O'Hare. And so she's definitely excited to be here, and I'm sure that Chicago's going to give them a warm welcome. All right, folks, we'll have to leave it there. That's it for the Weekly News Recap. My thanks to WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel, Julie Bosman of the New York Times, and Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Micah Yasin. The news cycle moves fast, so our weekly news recap gives us the opportunity to slow it down. Now, if you enjoy our recap as much as we do, consider leaving us a rating and liking this podcast. It helps us share these stories with more people in and around the city. Thank you for listening, and have a great weekend.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.